Welcome to Double Take with Matt and Jake. This is Jake here, hoping everyone's had a chance to check out the website, mjdoubletake.com. And wherever you're listening to this, Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, really anywhere you get your podcasts, please subscribe, rate, review, 5 stars only. Leave a comment about why you like us so much. Really appreciate it. Helps us out a lot. Joined by Matt, as always. I'm back in Arizona. He's in Utah, so not together. Once again, and Matt, you have the day off from school, which is why we're doing this at 12 on a Friday.
Yeah, no, it works out pretty good. Nice for me. We had parent-teacher conferences yesterday, so they gave us the day off because we had to stay late for the last couple of days. But yeah, no, it's nice to just, you know, sleep in the morning. I love it.
It is nice sleeping in. I agree. I slept in myself because I'm on that unemployment grind right now. Here's what we're going to talk about today, folks. So last weekend I was in LA, so we're going to talk. I went to the USC-Utah football game. Going to talk about that. I went to the LAFC soccer game against Toronto, so we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the MLS for a little bit as well. Then the second half, that's going to be the first half of the show. Also, I forgot. I apologize. But the second half of the show, we're going to talk about the Philadelphia Eagles game last night. They beat the Green Bay Packers. Even though they won, though, I'm really concerned at the lack of corner depth they have in the secondary. It was a problem last year. Matt's a big Eagles guy, so it was pretty easy to get him to sign off on talking about the Eagles. But their lack of corner concerns me. So that's what we're going to talk about the second half of the show. But first, we're going to talk about an article that, by the time you're listening to this, will be on the website. It's about the University of Miami's three linebackers, and they got Zach McLeod, Michael Pickney, and Shaq Quarterman. They're the best linebacking core in the country right now. So I did a little write-up when North Carolina was about to face Miami on these linebackers, and I thought, you know, this is actually really fun to watch going to film on these guys. So I wrote just a little write-up for everybody. So, Matt, you're editing it right now. I'm assuming you didn't really know much about these guys.
I didn't. I actually saw a little thing. I guess Trevor Maddich goes around to some different colleges that that interest him. And one of the things, place that he went to was Miami. And so because he wanted to talk about these linebackers as well. So I knew kind of, you know, that they were a big deal. I didn't know the stuff that you talked about, the different roles. One thing you talked about that I thought was interesting that I didn't understand. So I know that there is a strong side and a weak side in football. I didn't really know which is which. I mostly know that existed because of Remember the Titans. But you talked about how the linebackers have different roles, whereas I thought that the left and the right linebacker would do pretty much the same thing, and they would just flip based on which way the run was going.
Yeah, so strong side linebacker, that's one of the things I liked about, and that's something that playing and watching film, you kind of learn. It's one of those minor intricacies that, you know, watching, you don't really explain as much. So, for example, a weak side linebacker, I think the one who gets the most credit in the NFL is Sean Lee, the Dallas Cowboys former linebacker there.
Thomas, I think we should pick somebody else.
Well, the other guy's Thomas Davis. Used to play for the Panthers. Now he's with the Chargers. He's one of those like famous weak side linebackers. They're in space a lot. So when you hear sideline to sideline, that's usually referring to a weak side linebacker. Strong side linebackers, they're fighting through a lot. They're usually stopping because if offense has blockers on the strong side, that generally means that the run's going to come that way unless it's like a reverse or some sort of a cutback. So they're often not even trying to tackle. They're just trying to push the movement of the play back inside to the weak side linebacker. So weak side linebackers are going to have more tackles than a strong side linebacker. So that's something I go into as well on top of these three, just specifically their roles at Miami, what they do. Trying to include some film, depending on if the website's going to let us do that, or some YouTube plays from them. But check it out. It's mjdoubletake.com. Even if you don't like Miami, it's just one of those things that I like football, so I liked writing it. And Matt, yeah, it's someone you watch. I'd say I know more, but I think you watch as much football as me, so it sounded like you kind of got something out of it as well.
Yeah, no, I definitely did. I mean, you watch a lot more football than I do, but you watch like the amount that a coach watches.
I do watch a lot of football. I'm watching right now. I'm watching the LSU Vanderbilt game from last week.
See, I don't go back and watch football games that have already happened.
Yeah, I like doing that. But anyway, so check that out. That's on the website. Again, even if you're not a Miami fan, it's probably especially if you're not a Miami fan, just a football fan in general. Best linebacker core in the country. So check it out there. Matt, let's start with as far as my recent travels. Let's start the USC game because we're going to talk about soccer. So I think the LSC will segue into soccer a bit better. Let's talk about the USC game. So we've never been to the Coliseum. Well, Matt and I have been to the Coliseum. Not in it for a game, though. So it was my first time going to a game of the Coliseum. And if you haven't been to USC's campus, Matt knows I'm obsessed with this place. So there's a very good Korean restaurant right outside the Coliseum. Don't remember the name, but it's very good.
It's like fine.
I thought it was fantastic.
You know, like, it's good, but, like, I don't know. Like, I've been to a lot of good Korean restaurants. And I just thought this was like a solid, good restaurant.
Well, anyway, so here's what I thought of the game. And Matt, did you get to watch the game or see the game at all? The Utah-USC game?
I did not actually get to see this game.
So here's what I was expecting. So the week before, USC lost to BYU in overtime. So they're 2-1. Keaton Slovis, their true freshman quarterback, gets hurt the second play of the game. So you got the number 10 team in the country, Utah, coming in. They have arguably the best secondary. I think Cal's secondary as a whole is better, but I think Utah's the best cornerback in the country, Jalen Johnson. Their safety, Julian Blackman's an all-conference player as well. And USC, because Keaton Slovis went down, so their starting quarterback, JT Daniels, got hurt the first game of the season against Fresno State. So Slovis was the backup. The third-string guy coming out of camp was Jack Sears from San Clemente High School, where Sam Darnold went. But he transferred because he was a third-string guy, not the backup. So the guy they were playing was named Matt Fink, who coming out of camp was a fourth-string quarterback. He almost transferred to Illinois himself. So lucky for USC, they didn't transfer there. And also lucky for Matt Fink is USC has had the top receiver in the last three recruiting class. And in particular, Michael Pittman just dominated Utah's secondary. Because what Utah does is instead of having Jalen Johnson, that cornerback I was talking about, shadow the best receiver, they had him on the left side of the defense. So Utah's number two corner would be on the right side. So USC just lined Michael Pittman up on the left side of the offense the entire game. And then who I think is USC's best receiver, Amon-Ra St. Brown, he was in the slot for most of the game, and he did damage as well. But, man, it was an ugly game. Like, I think there were 27 penalties between the two teams. But, you know, penalties aside, USC is so – like, Michael Pittman's just a matchup nightmare is what I came away with. And also just big picture-wise, the Coliseum's a cool stadium. You know, the band needs to learn a second song, I will say that, because they're playing Fight On the entire time. And it's a good song. I like Fight On, but they could learn a second one. But love the Coliseum. Great atmosphere. It was my first time there for a game. I think it says more about USC than Utah. I thought Utah was going to lose that game, and they were still the favorite to win the South. USC plays Washington this week, so that's going to be a rough game for them. And by the time you're listening to this, they might have already played Washington. But, it was, yeah, cool atmosphere, cool game, a little sloppy. And it saved Clay Helton's job because reports coming out of L.A. were that if USC would have gotten embarrassed by Utah, then they were going to fire Clay Helton a la Lane Kiffin on the tarmac.
So that's interesting. So you thought that USC was going to beat Utah?
I did, because their USC, Utah hasn't won ever in the Coliseum. The last time they won a road game against USC was in 1916. And no matter how bad of a year USC is having, and honestly, like, an overtime loss to BYU isn't as bad of a loss, I think, as some people are saying it is. But USC is just more talented than Utah, and they really – Utah's second corner spot, there's two guys who kind of rotate in there, and that's been a big question mark for me the entire season, and USC just exploited that. Offensive coordinator Graham Harrell had, I thought, a really good game plan for USC. I thought USC was going to win, but I still think Utah's going to win the South in the Pac-12.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it does. That for me has seemed to be the team that Utah struggled with more than anybody else. I mean, maybe you could talk about, you know, Oregon or Washington, although Utah has at least beaten Oregon, I know. But yeah, as far as those teams in the South, USC has been the one that's really gotten their number more often than not.
Yeah, Utah's 3-6 against USC since Utah joined the Pac-12, and all three of those wins were the last three home games for Utah. So they have gone back and forth the last few years between, but Utah hasn't proven they can win on the road, and they've only beaten Washington once since joining the conference as well. That was a game in Seattle, which was good for Utah, but that was before Chris Peterson really kind of got the program going the right way. But yeah, and Arizona State is going to be another tough game for Utah. So if Arizona State, I think people are sleeping on. I know they lost to Colorado last week, but I think Arizona State, Utah, and USC, I'd say all within 30, like all are co-favorites, if you will, like should be within 5 or 10% chance of each other winning the Pac-12 South, yeah. At least.
Yeah. Now let's say, how many more games do you think Utah could lose and still win the South?
So last year they won it with 3 conference losses. I think because one of the losses is to USC this year, they would need USC to have 4 conference losses if they did that again. So I think Utah can theoretically only lose one other game and feel comfortable, or excuse me, lose one other game. They're playing Washington State this week. So they lose to Washington State because they still have to go to Seattle to play Washington. Then they're in trouble. But let's say the Arizona State game and the Washington games are going to be the key games for Utah, because if they lose the Arizona State game, that's 2 conference losses to their 2 biggest competitors in the division. So they're going to need a lot of help. So I think Utah's still fine, but they're almost no margin for error at this point. I think they can only lose one more game and have a realistic shot at the South.
Yeah. Now, so if the Pac-12 champion has 2 losses, do you think that's a team that makes the playoffs, or do you think that ship has sailed?
I think it's sailed. I think Washington and Oregon realistically are the only teams with a shot, and both of them would have to win out. And if you look at it, I think so. And even Notre Dame, a one-loss Notre Dame team, I think is going to be out, because you'd have to bank on Ohio State having 2 losses. You'd have to bank on Oklahoma or Texas having 2 losses as well. And I don't know if we think Oklahoma is going to lose twice this year at this point. I don't think Ohio State usually does lose to – they could lose to Nebraska this weekend, because they usually lose one of those weird fluky games on the road. But – and you look at the SEC, there's LSU, Georgia, and Alabama. One of them's making it for sure. I think a second one of those teams is as well. So I think unless Oregon or Washington runs the table with 1 loss at this point, when I say run the table, like from this point on, and there's help like the SEC, like a couple of those, even a 2-loss Georgia team, I think would get in over a 1 loss. Like if Georgia's 2 losses are like a close game to Florida, and then the SEC championship game to Alabama, for example, I think that would get in over a 1-loss Washington team. So I think it'd be really hard for the Pac-12 unless the SEC really messes itself up. And Clemson's going to take a spot almost for sure as well.
Yeah, that is crazy how much work the Pac-12 has to do. I mean, I agree with everything that you said. It's just, you know, that goes back to the 4-team limit that we've talked about extensively.
It's hard because, like, you look at the Washington State UCLA game, and Washington State threw, like, their quarterback Gordon threw 9 touchdown passes and they lost that game. Like, there's just no other conference that literally anyone can win any week like the Pac-12,
right?
Which ends up screwing them a lot.
Yeah, unfortunately. So, you know, yeah, better than being independent, I guess.
Yeah, because Notre Dame, I think, like, again, I think Notre Dame, a 1-loss Notre Dame team would almost have a better shot than a 1-loss Pac-12 team, just because they are good. They went to the playoff last year. So I think, let's say Oklahoma loses, like, gets upset by Baylor or something like that, loses to Texas. So they got 2 losses. Texas loses also to Oklahoma, let's say in the Big 12 championship. So Texas has 2 losses. Let's say Ohio State loses tonight, loses to Penn State, wins the Big 10, but they're a 2-loss team. I think at that point you could be talking about Notre Dame or one loss Pac-12 team getting in, but I think it'd be hard with all the SEC teams.
Yeah.
I think it's not the most probable thing, but the hype, the idea of Clemson, Alabama, Georgia, and LSU all in the playoff is not that far-fetched. So let's say like Ohio State and Oklahoma have those two losses. Let's say LSU beats Alabama and then barely loses to Georgia in the SEC championship game. Let's say Georgia goes undefeated and Alabama only has that one loss to LSU or even Auburn. We'll just stick with LSU, but Auburn's a technically a possibility as well. So you'd have a undefeated Georgia. They're getting in 100% or like undefeated SEC championship. You have a one loss LSU team that beat Alabama, and then you have Alabama. So I think it'd be hard for those three teams to not get in.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, no, I do think the SEC gets a little bit overrated and they get credit, you know, maybe where sometimes they don't necessarily deserve it. But I mean, it is the best conference. Like, I don't think we can really debate that. I mean, if there's any conference that gets two or even three teams in, it should definitely be the SEC.
Yeah, and if you look at wins against other conferences, you look at especially NFL draft picks and national championships, it's not even close. The SEC is the best conference. You can say the bottom of the conference is as bad as everybody else, but it's hard to argue there's a better depth at the top of the conference than the SEC.
Yes, yeah. For sure.
Like the third best team, the third best team in the SEC is probably either LSU or Georgia. And you look, let's say Big Ten, who's the third best team there? Penn State, maybe Michigan State.
Right. Yeah.
Third best team, the Big 12. Like is it Oklahoma State?
Or Texas, like Oklahoma State might be better than Texas.
Yeah. That game was close between Texas and Oklahoma State, but that's my point. Like if Oklahoma State's in your top three in your conference, if Penn State or like Nebraska or because in the Big Ten, it's Ohio State and Wisconsin. So the third best team is probably Penn State. I don't think anyone's picking Penn State or Oklahoma State over LSU or Georgia.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either. Yeah. I think that's.
Well, it just
means. Just got to add.
It just means more.
More teams. That's the only way to fix it.
Yeah. Let's talk about soccer because that was the next thing I did. So the football game was on Friday. The next day I went to a LAFC game against Toronto. So they ended up drawing Toronto 1-1. Carlos Vela is very good. And, Matt, it was a fun game. Their, like, supporter section was going hard the whole time. I think it was my second MLS stadium because I think I'd only been to Real Salt Lake Stadium before for a game. But it was really
– right.
And I don't know how accurate this is, but remember a couple episodes ago we were talking about LAFC fans, like where do they come from? And my friend I was at the game with was saying a lot of them were Chivas USA fans that became LAFC fans. And, again, I don't know how accurate this is, what he was telling me, but he was saying if you look at the Galaxy's best players, it's been Landon Donovan, David Beckham, Roy Keane. Is it Roy or Robbie Keane?
Robbie. Roy Keane also plays soccer, but not for the
Robbie.
Galaxy.
So Robbie Keane and Ibrahimovic were all white guys. And then LAFC's best player is Carlos Vela, who plays or has played for the Mexican national team. And I honestly, it was like, I'd say maybe 80 to 90% a Hispanic crowd at the game.
Yeah.
Which is interesting
because when they came out, like, it was owned by, okay, this is going to be a team that's owned by Magic Johnson and Mia Hamm and Will Ferrell. That Bob Bradley is the coach. Their colors are black and gold. It seemed like the rich team to me. Like the rich, like the Hollywood, kind of like the Los Angeles Lakers, you know what I mean? And, yeah, you know, that's just not what it's become. Like you said, you know, Carlos Vela, being more Chivas fans, but I thought it was going to be like more like the Hollywood team, but like Zlatan's definitely the Hollywood type player, not necessarily because he's a big European player, but because he talks a lot, he brags, he's real, you know, always talking about how big of a deal he is. I don't think I've heard Carlos Vela talk or even a quote of what he said.
Yeah, I don't think it's kind of like how we didn't hear Kawhi's voice for years in the NBA. You know, like yeah. I've seen videos of him a lot scoring, but I don't think I've seen an interview. So,
right. Yeah, and like I don't really remember Robbie Keane talking, but like I know what Landon Donovan sounds like. I've heard Landon Donovan talk. Landon Donovan was a big superstar like that.
Yeah, so. We all know what David Beckham sounds like. I'm David Beckham.
Yeah. But even if they did all used to be Chivas USA fans, and that's fine that Carlos Vela was a star, but like the Galaxy, you know, they did have they had both of the Dos Santos brothers and stuff. And like that just brings us back to the original point. It's like, okay, where did the Chivas fans come from? Why weren't they just LA Galaxy fans? Because we mentioned this last time specifically, but like not every Mexican who lives in LA is going to be a Chivas fan. A lot of them like Club America and Guadalajara. So like, how come those fans don't just cheer for the Galaxy?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of thinking it just came down to it was a new thing in marketing, just because I can't come up with a better explanation for where these fans are coming from.
Right.
And they do see, yeah, because they have a mix between, I think they really pushed Carlos Vela as far as LAFC. And they do have the mix as well of having Will Ferrell, Magic Johnson, Mia Hamm. It's the LAFC stadium's right next to USC, so they're kind of pushing that like downtown Los Angeles, heart of Los Angeles type stuff. So business strategy, I think just their business strategy, their marketing department have just done a great job so far. And also they put together maybe the best team in MLS history. So
yeah, that helps.
Yeah. Winning. I think that you can't deny that. I think winning definitely helps for sure. It's hard to get a team excited. It's hard to get like new fans excited about a borderline playoff run. Mm-hmm. So that's our LAFC conversation there. And the MLS playoffs are only about a week or two away. The Galaxy are – I don't have the table pulled up, but the Galaxy just secured a spot. Minnesota secured a spot. Real Salt Lake is on the outside. Well, they're on the – they're in the playoff picture, but they haven't secured a spot yet from my understanding.
Yeah, no, they have not yet. They're still – let me get these pulled up real quick.
They lost to the Galaxy a couple nights ago. It was the – 10-year anniversary of Real Salt Lake beating the Galaxy in the MLS Cup to win the only championship they have. But the Galaxy won 2-1, which secured a spot for the Galaxy, and not Real Salt Lake still trying to secure their spot yet.
Yeah, and they are in a good position right now. So there's four teams that it looks like haven't clinched. Real Salt Lake, Portland, FC Dallas, and San Jose. Colorado might be able to sneak in. I don't think so. Sporting Kansas City and Houston have both definitely been eliminated. But Real has 3 points on San Jose. They've played the same number of matches, meaning that if RSL wins out, then they'll get in. They control their own destiny. They play Houston at home on Sunday. That's going to be Nick Raimondo's final home game, accepting the playoffs. We wouldn't host the first round of the playoffs. We would get a home and home if we get into the next round of the playoffs. So right now we'd be playing the Seattle Sounders. The two teams that Real has to play left to get in are Houston and Vancouver, who have both already been eliminated from the playoffs. So I would say Real has a very, very good chance of getting into the playoffs. They tend to play well in the, you know, these last couple of weeks of the season. What has been the problem is not being in a playoff season by that time. So they can still get in. They can still theoretically get as high. Well, I mean, I guess if Minnesota lost, they could theoretically get as high as second. I think getting one of the third or the fourth spots is more likely. LA and Seattle would almost have to have a harder schedule than Real has.
So, yeah, definitely playoffs start within a week or two. MLS playoffs, I think, are some of the funnest soccer to watch. So that's going to be fun. We're going to talk about that. But it is football season, so we're going to finish. We got about 15, 20 minutes left. We're going to finish with football, specifically the Eagles game last night. Specifically, their lack of corner depth. So they beat the Packers 34-27. So they went to 2-2 on the year, which they really need that game. You go 1-3, that puts yourself in a big hole, especially with what Dallas has done so far. But here's my issue with the Eagles, Matt, is in the first round last year, they drafted left tackle, who I think is playing right tackle for him right now. But Andre Dillard from Washington is actually not even starting. He's a backup, which, you know, you need offensive line depth, so that's not the issue. And I thought he was the best pass protecting tackle in the draft. But they traded up to get him. They traded up from 25 to 22, and they didn't get Byron Jones, or excuse me, Byron Murphy, who's a cornerback from Washington. They didn't get Greedy Williams, a cornerback from LSU. DeAndre Baker, the cornerback from Georgia, was on the board. I think they should have gone Byron Murphy, but we talked so many times, Matt, what happened to the Falcons and honestly the Eagles last year is the best way to lose in the NFL is to have multiple injuries at the same position. Let's look at the corner depth chart. So you got Ronald Darby, he's a good corner, but on the opposite side of him, you had Sidney Jones, who's hurt with a hamstring issue. Avante Maddox got carted off the field last night, so hoping he's well. I think reports from the Eagles are saying like he's doing okay, moving and everything like that. And then backing up Ronald Darby ended up playing is there's Rasul Douglas, who I'm just reading his name. I couldn't tell you anything about him. And then they had an undrafted guy, I think it's the second year in the league, from Southern Illinois, playing last night as well. And you just cannot have too many corners in the league, and it's really the only big hole in the Eagles roster, but it's that they're probably the most important defensive position. And if they continue to struggle, continue to be about a 500 team, if they don't pass Dallas and end up winning this division, it's going to be because of their cornerbacks, and that happened last year as well.
I know, and it's weird that we don't have more cornerbacks, because like you said, so both those people are hurt. We knew going into the draft we needed more cornerbacks, and I get why they drafted Andre Dillard. I actually like it, just because part of the reason that the Eagles have been so good is because Jason Peters has been just such a force at that left tackle position. He's getting older. He's going to retire in the next couple of years, so we do need a good left tackle to replace him. So if they feel like Andre Dillard can do that, I'd say go ahead and do it. But like, I don't know, sign some people in free agency. Like, you've got to do something.
It's just hard because, you know, on the offensive line, as far as the Eagles go, Lane Johnson and Jason Peters are both getting older. So offensive line was the other thing I think they needed and they got. So it's not even a bad pick. It's just hard to look at their depth chart and think we don't need a cornerback with the first round pick right here, because all those guys are still available. If they were all gone, I get, okay, let's get Dillard and then get a corner in the second or third. But they were all still available. I don't get it. I legit don't get it.
I know. It doesn't. Yeah, the Eagles, yeah, I don't know. We're in trouble, man. We're just
Byron Murphy
in trouble. I know who won such yesterday, but like, I'm not convinced that the Packers are very good yet.
Murphy would have been such a perfect corner there. And I'm looking, the Eagles didn't draft a corner at all. They only had four picks and they used it on. So the second round pick was Miles Sanders, who played pretty well last night, running back from Penn State. Then they got JJ Arcega-Whiteside, receiver from Stanford, another need. So like all the draft, they did well. Their fourth round, it was a defensive end from Penn State. They had a fifth because they drafted Clayton Thorson, a quarterback from Northwestern. And I'm always in favor of taking a quarterback every year and just seeing what happens. But it's just hard to not draft a corner. You know what I mean? Like more, I think quarterback and cornerback, I think there's an argument you should be taking at least one every year in the draft, because corners are so important. You can't have too many, and quarterbacks, it's worth the risk if in case you hit on one.
Yeah, it was funny about it. The reason, or part of the reason at least, that we didn't have those draft picks for that year is because we traded away all those picks to move up to take Carson Wentz. And so that's finally coming back to hurt us. And the reason that we did that is because we felt like we, you know, would be good to win the Super Bowl in the next couple of years. And then we did do that, But one of the only people who didn't play was Carson Wentz.
Yeah, which is ironic. I still can't believe the Eagles ended up winning that Super Bowl. Now, let me ask you this, because I've heard, and I disagree with this, and I hate how much we talk about Nick Foles on this podcast, but it just keeps, like, honestly, naturally coming up. I'm not trying. I actually go out of my way to not talk about Nick Foles, but here we are. I've heard some media members, I haven't heard anyone in the Philadelphia say this, and I don't think they would, but some people are, like, in the media, they're saying that they think that the Eagles wish they had Nick Foles. And I don't think that, because there's no way you can watch Carson Wentz and Nick Foles and think Nick Foles is the guy I would rather have. Like, if you watch Carson Wentz on that, it's obvious how talented the guy is. What's your thought on that, though?
You know, Bomani Jones made a very interesting point about this. And what he said was that clearly Carson Wentz is a better quarterback than Nick Foles. The difference between them, and part of the reason the Eagles seem to have more success with Nick Foles, is that Carson Wentz's go-to receiver is Zach Ertz. And Zach Ertz is great. I believe he broke a record last season for the most receptions by a tight end, or most reception yards. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Because him and George Kittle, I think, both broke that record for most reception yards by a tight end last season.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that's great, and you're going to do well if you're throwing the ball to Zach Ertz. Nick Foles' go-to receiver, though, was Alshon Jeffrey. And so with Nick Foles, you were getting a lot bigger plays than you do with Carson Wentz. And that spreads out the field a lot more. It opens up the running game. And so it seemed to fit better with the offense, and especially now if you're looking for a quarterback who's going to go bigger, is, you know, we've got Alshon Jeffrey, we've got DeSean Jackson. That's the kind of thing that we want to do. And, like, look, Carson Wentz probably has a stronger arm than Nick Foles. I don't even think I'd need to say probably. I think we can say Carson Wentz does have a stronger arm. So we've just got to get Carson Wentz throwing the ball to Alshon Jeffrey and DeSean Jackson more.
Yeah, and, you know, Alshon Jeffrey played last night with a calf injury. He missed the week before that. DeSean Jackson missed last week as well. He's expected back. I think that's another thing. Also, like, if we're looking big picture, even though the Eagles are 2-2, and corner is a serious concern. So, you know, not negating anything I've said, but they should have won the Atlanta game with that Aguilar drop. They could have won the Detroit game. They've been down by 10 points in every game they've been in. So I think honestly, a lot of their problems, except for cornerback depth, are correctable. So I'm not worried about the Eagles at all. But if Dallas wins Sunday night against New Orleans and goes 4-0, Philadelphia's already two games back in the division. So that makes that Dallas game, which is in a week or two, a couple weeks. I think it's so that, because the Eagles play the Jets next week, and then they play, I think, Dallas after that. That game becomes as close to a must win in week six as you can have for Philadelphia. Because if you go three games down before the first half of the season is over, that's going to be hard for Philadelphia to come back from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think it is good that we got the win yesterday, though, because I think, you know, making the playoffs from 1-2 is a lot easier than making it from 1-3. I'm not panicked yet. I think, you know, we figured out, I think we win some more of those close games. But yeah, now's the time. We got to start doing it right now.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. I'm still buying the Eagles, though. Now, we're about 35 minutes so far. Do you want to do the program thing, or do you want to save that for next week?
Whatever you think.
Let's just do it, because I think we can do it quick. I'll just go through my top five jobs, I think, in college football, and you can agree or disagree with me. Sound good? Because we usually go about 45 minutes. We've called a couple short, but Matt's home from work. I'm not working at all. We got some time. I actually have a top 10 list, Matt, so let's run through the list real quick when we talk about it, and then we'll call it. Should I start at number one or number 10? Okay, 10th best job in the country, Florida State.
Yeah. Okay, I think that I'm interested in hearing the rest of them, but seems like a good enough job.
So you're okay with them being top 10? Okay, number 9.
I think so. I want to hear some of these other ones, see if there's anybody that you left out. But I think they're deserving of a top
number
10
nine,
spot.
I think, is where I might have the most issues with people, but I legit think it's a top 10 job, Texas A&M.
I mean,
it's in Texas, and they have a expletive amount of money. So that's why they got that for me.
Yeah.
Because recruiting and money are two very important things, and Texas A&M has that.
Yep, and Jimbo Fisher left Florida State to go to Texas A&M, so that that would make sense.
Number eight, I got Oklahoma.
I would think Oklahoma would be a little bit higher just because they got, you know, they're putting so much more money into the program and they have more history, so we'll have to see.
I thought so too, but I think I'm justified putting them at eight. Number seven, I had Florida. Number six, that's Florida Gators at seven. Six, I had Texas Longhorns. Right. So that's the bottom half of the top 10. So Florida State, Texas A&M, Oklahoma, Florida, and Texas.
I feel like Oklahoma's a better job than
Well, let
Florida.
Me explain why I think Florida's a better job. They're in the SEC East, so they're still in the SEC, but they're not in the Alabama division, so that's a point for Florida. Because they're in the SEC – and we talked about this at the start of the show. They just, for better or for worse, real or not, they're presumed to be in the best conference. So let's say Florida picks it up and they get on Georgia's level, they could get the benefit of the doubt that Oklahoma might not. Also, they're in Florida. They have a more natural recruiting base. Oklahoma has to go, and they've done it well, but they still have to go across the entire country. Oklahoma has to go to Florida, has to go to Texas, has to go to California. Florida can just stay in Florida and Georgia, like, and just go up to Atlanta and recruit, and they're fine. So I think the natural recruiting base and being the SEC East specifically is why the Florida job, I think, is better than the Oklahoma job, because Oklahoma has no natural reason for being good, which makes what they've done. I think Oklahoma and Alabama – because, again, they have no natural resources for being talented or being good at football, and yet they're so good, is makes them the two most impressive programs in the country. But that doesn't make it an easy job.
Yes, that makes sense. I get what you're saying. It is weird, you know, that Oklahoma has had so much more success than Florida, at least in recent years.
Yeah, Florida, I think, should be better than they are. And I think Dan Mullen is honestly a really good coach. So I think they're going to be good. They had a lot of transfers this year. So I that hurt them. But if they can figure that out, and honestly, they had a lot of cornerback transfers, Matt. So the secondary depth is the reason they're not going to beat Georgia. But I honestly think they're on the right track to being in that top tier in the SEC pretty soon.
All right. Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to say, I mean, it was fun, you know, those Urban Meyer years with Tim Tebow and everything. It's fun to watch Florida. Since that's one of those teams, you know, where you kind of want them to be good, even if you don't like them.
I think the SEC, when it's at its best, it's at its highest entertainment value, is when the Florida-Georgia rivalry is good and you got that SEC East rivalry going on. And then LSU-Alabama. We got three out of those four teams right now. If Georgia can pick it up, Florida can pick it up and be on that level with LSU, Georgia, and Alabama, then that just is going to be the most – because right now Georgia's a shoo-in pretty much to go to the SEC championship game. If Florida can make it a competition and make that game in Jacksonville a question mark, then that's going to be the – I think the best thing for college football is having the SEC have all those teams be really good.
Right, yeah, because right now it's just I don't really watch the SEC at all, just because I know that, like, Alabama.
And the people who complain about the SEC, Matt, I'm not saying you're complaining, but people who complain about the SEC are saying the SEC East, there's no competition there, so only half the conference is good. If Georgia was on, or excuse me, Florida was on that level, then you couldn't make that argument. Like, if the SEC East had two top 10 programs, no matter how bad Missouri, South Carolina, Tennessee are, you got Florida and Georgia at their potential, then that's a heck of a division.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that – yeah, if we can get that going, then the SEC is, you know, kind of the most competitive. I think that would take away the most competitive title away from the Pac-12.
All right, so here's my top five. And I want to stress when I'm going over the top five, for the entire top 10, the factors I was looking at was natural recruiting base, geographic isolation as far as, like, competition – how easy it is to win your conference, and also job security. So number five is Miami. I didn't think would be there, but they're in Miami. The closest team to them is Florida, which is – so they still have to recruit against Florida and Florida State. And honestly, the entire country goes into Miami. But I think Miami is one of the top three cities where kids grow up there thinking, I want to play for Miami. Just like it used to be at Texas, like it's at two of the other schools that are higher on the list. There's the one thing you can't do in recruiting is convince a kid to not go to a dream school. And I think Miami's more kids' dream school in South Florida than a lot of other programs have. That's why Oklahoma's lower. Like no one – like Oklahoma just doesn't have enough kids like that. Like Baker Mayfield, his dream school is Oklahoma. He grew up in Austin. You know what I mean? So that's what Miami has going for him. That's why they're number five.
Yeah. So I agree with you. Theoretically, Miami should
Miami should be very good. I don't love that they play in the Orange Bowl, which is not an on-campus stadium. Their facilities aren't very good. That's why they're only number five. But they're a private school, which helps. So overall, I'm high on Miami. And also, they're in the ACC Coastal, so their toughest competition to win the division is usually like Pittsburgh and Virginia, which makes it an easy job as well, just because you're not competing against Alabama. You're not competing against Georgia. Even in the ACC, you're not competing against Clemson and Florida State to win your division.
Mm-hmm.
So it's number five. Number four is Georgia. Same thing. Atlanta. As much as everyone in the country goes in to recruit Atlanta, it's still Georgia's home turf, which is a bigger reason as any why they're number four. They're in the SEC, so that's hard, but right now with Florida being down, there's not as much competition in their division.
Yep, no, I agree with that. Yeah, Georgia's the one that like makes the most sense to me. It's like this school should be very good, and recently they have been very good.
I honestly think talent-wise they're on par with Alabama and Clemson. They just haven't gotten the job done, but we'll see what happens this year. Number three is Ohio State. It's the top job because their Ohio doesn't have as natural a recruiting base as these other schools we're talking about, especially in the South. But they recruit nationally just like Oklahoma does. B, it's easier to win, I think, their division than it is for Oklahoma to win the entire conference, because Oklahoma doesn't have divisions, so they got to just win the conference straight up. Ohio State can win their division then if they're in the Big Ten championship. So that's why I had Ohio State 3 and Oklahoma 8, even though I think they're really similar programs from a macro level perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with that, yeah. They're, you know, despite the fact that they're lacking, I think all that stuff you said about the conference, that really, really helps.
Number two is LSU because, you know, population-wise, it's smaller than Atlanta. It's smaller than Dallas. It's smaller than Los Angeles. But every kid in Louisiana grows up wanting to be a Tiger. So Ed Orgeron really has that whole state on lockdown, and they have the money, they have the facilities, they have – what's supposed to be, I haven't been there. I want to go really bad, but Death Valley at night is supposed to be the best atmosphere in college football. They have the history, they have the uniforms, they have the swagger, they have the NFL draft picks, all of that. They'd be number one if Nick Saban wasn't at Alabama, because that's what the only reason that Les Miles got fired is because it couldn't beat Nick Saban, which no one can.
Right. So I'm now realizing, let's say, you know, what you want to about Alabama, but then there's a very notable team that we've got to talk about.
Well, actually, Matt, Alabama's not in my top 10. They're not my number one team.
They're not.
No, the number one job in the country is USC.
Oh, we've got two notable things that we need to talk about then. Okay, let's.
Here's why USC is the best job in the country. Every other school we've talked about, Ohio State is Penn State, even though they're not on Ohio State's level. They got Penn State. They got Michigan. The SEC, there's four or five programs. Oklahoma has to battle Texas. The only school that doesn't have that competition is USC. The last time a Pac-12 team that was in the Pac-12 at the time won a national championship was 1927, Matt. USC is competing against a track school, a couple basketball schools, Yale with better weather. Utah's a gymnastics school. They have no competition at all. UCLA can't figure it out for whatever reason. UCLA should be better, but they're not. USC has 11 national championships. The other teams in the conference have 9 combined. There's no better. And also, everyone in LA wants to be a Trojan. Literally, everyone in Southern California grows up wanting to play for USC. When Clay Helton was just the interim coach, and after Steve Sarkisian got fired, a Pac-12 coach was recruiting a kid in Southern California. This is, he told it under anonymity, is why I'm not naming names. But the kid said, "Sorry, coach, I'm committed to USC." And the coach was like, "Well, they don't even have a head coach. Like, what are you taught? What do you mean?" And the kid was like, "They're USC. They're going to get someone good. Like, no other program has that cachet." So the money, the recruiting base, which is as good as any in the country, and on top of that many kids in Southern California just being there, all of them want to play for USC. That's why USC is the number one job.
Okay, so I agree with everything that you just said, but you've left out both Clemson and Alabama.
And I did that intentionally. You want me to start with Alabama or Clemson?
I'll make my counterpoint, right, and then you can respond to that. I feel like Alabama is, you know, it's maybe not in the biggest state for recruiting. Same thing with Clemson being in South Carolina and having South Carolina University be in the same – or University of South Carolina be in the same state. You know, lower population, not as attractive of a city for the recruits, all that sort of thing. I just feel like you have undervalued what it is, not necessarily from a kid's perspective, but from a coach's perspective, to have your university say, "We will give you all of the money that you want and that you need. We just want you to win." And so Alabama and Clemson, they have everything they want. They have the best facilities. And because of that, and also just because of the prestige that comes with going to Alabama, going to Clemson, knowing, like, if you're Nick Saban, you can go to a kid and be like, "Look, you are one of the best football players in the country. If football is actually the most important thing to you and you want the best chance of going to the NFL, we have the best chance of giving it to you." And I think that that does a lot to overcome some of those other recruiting challenges that they might have. And if you look at the recruiting classes, it has, because for years, those two universities have had the best two recruiting classes.
But let's stick with Alabama, Matt. What if you're not Nick Saban? What if you're the guy after Nick Saban? Alabama fired a guy because he had 2 losses and won the SEC championship, and they still fired him after that year. They're just – the difference between Oklahoma and Alabama and Ohio State and Alabama is they're not going to fire you after you win the conference. So job security is the only reason Alabama wasn't on the top 10, because unless you're – even if Nick Saban – let's say Nick Saban loses to LSU this year and doesn't go to the SEC championship, I guarantee you there are going to be people saying, "Oh, Nick Saban's over the hill. You know, his college football is moving on. He can't do it anymore. He's getting too old." If he has 1 loss to LSU, that's going to happen.
Yeah. I guess it depends on your attitude as a coach. I feel – I mean, Clemson and Alabama still have, you know, more potential for success. So I don't know if that necessarily puts them number 1 or in the top 5 based on your criteria. I just feel like having the greatest potential of success should put you in the top 10, even if it comes at the expense
of and potential. Alabama's higher. I still think USC has the most potential because of the lack of competition, because Alabama still has to play LSU. They still have to play Georgia. They still have to play Florida. Clemson, the reason they weren't on list is no one's shown that unless you're Dabo Sweeney, you can be this good. They won a national championship in 1981. And other than that, they've had, I don't want to say zero. It's not like they were going 2-11 every year, but they were not very good for pretty much their entire history. They were a school with a lot of traditions, a great home fan base that just, you know, 9-4, 8-5 was kind of what they were at. And I haven't seen a second coach do it besides Dabo Sweeney. So I don't know if you can win at Clemson unless you're Dabo Sweeney, because it's in South Carolina. I don't mind that they're competing against the University of South Carolina for recruits, because there's so many kids in Atlanta that, you know, there's enough for everybody to go around. But Sweeney's done such a good job recruiting, and they do have the facilities. They do have the money. So that is definitely helping Clemson. I just would like to see a second coach do it before that's like a destination job. You know what I mean? I just think Dabo Sweeney has the perfect setup. He has Brent Venables, the defensive coordinator. They're paying him, and this goes into the money. So I guess this is a pro for your point, but they're paying him a stupid amount of money just to be a defensive coordinator because of how valuable he is to the program. So the money they're throwing in helps, but Texas A&M is throwing in that money as well. And they're in Texas, not South Carolina. So I think if Dabo Sweeney had the same setup at a lot of schools, they'd be doing really well. I don't think if a lot of coaches were in Clemson, they'd be doing what Dabo Sweeney's doing.
That's fair. I can give you that.
But no, definitely the money helps, and Clemson and Alabama have a ton of money. Clemson, the amount of money Clemson spends on assistants is ridiculous. So you thought I was going to have Bama number one, I'm guessing.
I did. Yeah,
no,
I didn't
think that. USC's number one. I'm actually writing an article about that, Matt. Once the Miami article comes out and y'all read that, the next article is coming out is, what's USC's deal? Why can't they figure it out? Because they should. And I'd go into all the advantages they have recruiting-wise. I'll talk about it in the next episode we do, because the next episode we do will probably be out by then. But I got a USC article coming up I'm excited about as well. Matt, we're at about 50 minutes. Anything else we want to talk about before we sign off?
Real Salt Lake retired Javier Morales' jersey on Wednesday. So shout out to El Maestro. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, shout out to him. Again, appreciate everybody listening to the end of the episode. Hope you liked it. Again, this is MJ Double Takes on Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Audioboom. It's on Google Podcasts now. It's on literally anywhere you get podcasts, you can find it. So listen, subscribe, rate, review, 5 stars only. Check out the website, mjdoubletake.com. Hit us up on social media, the podcast. It's at MJ Double Take for Twitter and Instagram. Matt's handle is at MattCowden24. Mine's at JacobCowden28. Appreciate everybody listening, and we'll talk to y'all next week.